Good morning. You might have noticed that Judy did not read the entire passage from Matthew. I asked her to stop at that point in the passage. In Matthew, we have a parable, and he almost always turns parables into allegories, which means figures stand for other figures, which means he embellishes the parable. Often, I would say, can detract or mislead us in the parable. He presents it as a ruler who's quite reactive, isn't he? He's going to throw a banquet, and the people he's invited don't come to the banquet, and he's furious. He's going to kill the people. He refers to them as murderers. He's full of amazing judgment, seething anger at this affront. That's how he experiences the situation. His fellow class men have not accepted the invitation. And so he strikes back. Why I had Judy stop where she did was scholars can reconstruct fairly well what the original parable was. And there is a very good scholar named Bernard Brandon Scott who does wonderful work on the parables. So I want to read to you what we believe the original parable, which is embellished by the different gospel writers, what that original parable was. And then we'll explore it together. And Bernard Brandon Scott gives names to the parables as he reconstructs them. And the name for this one is, What If No One Came? A man... Well, right away we have a difference here. It's not a ruler, it's a man. Gave a banquet, invited many. And at the time of the banquet, he sent a servant to say to those who had been invited, Come, for all is now ready. The first said to him, I have bought a field, and I must go out and see it. I pray you, have me excused. And another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to examine them. I pray you, have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. So the servant reported this to his master. And the master said, Go outside to the streets and bring back those whom you happen to meet, so that they may die. That's a very different parable. We have no idea when we invite people to gatherings why they may come, or why they can come or can't come. We often presume to know, but we don't. So this man, who's in a position of privilege in the first century, and he has power, and he initially invites those who are in his same position of privilege to dine with him, and they can't come. He doesn't get angry about it. He's not furious. He doesn't decide they're a bunch of murderers and thugs. He recognizes they're not going to come. He doesn't feel affronted. He doesn't feel shamed. But what he does do, he sees, well, I'll ask some other people to dine with me. But what's interesting, these other people he's going to invite to dine with him, he doesn't know. He's just going to invite anyone. And there goes the neighborhood. That's part of it. I mean, who knows? He doesn't know these people. And they're going to show up, and The other folks in his class are not going to appreciate these people coming in. It doesn't say he does it to try to pique them. He just is going to have a dinner. And the first folks didn't come, and he's going to invite some other folks. I find it rather amazing that we don't have a story of someone who just so beside himself, so angry, so insulted. It's not going to work out, so he'll invite other people. Would you do that? Would I? We are easily affronted. We're easily hurt. And when we're in a position of power and privilege, and we have the capacity to strike back at someone else, we often will do it. But he doesn't. That's what I find intriguing about it. What enables him to respond the way he does with such magnanimity and grace? And no attempt to lord it over anyone. I believe it's because he's returned to the land of his soul. That's how I describe it. He's returned to the land of his soul, and he knows who he is. And so he's able to respond in a way that often we don't as human beings, when we feel hurt. How do you and I, how do we return to the land of our soul and nurture our soul that we're more like this man today, rather than reactive striking back? I just lost my place. I'm getting older. So bear with me a second. It's an amazing thing not to strike back, to have the wherewithal in the land of our soul. There's the key, the land of our soul. In Isaiah today, he talks about the land of our soul as a mountain. It's a marvelous image, this mountain, which brings forth this banquet. Last week, he spoke of the land of our soul as a vineyard. And I think we can combine images. We're a vineyard on the slope of a mountain. That's the land of our soul. Have you seen vineyards like that? I have when I was in Italy. When Reese and I lived in California, I mean, these horrible fires, we spent a bit of time up in Sonoma and Napa. Some of those marvelous vineyards on the slope of hills. Just lush. So last month I talked about that our soul is a, we can understand it as an expression of God's song, that singing, that energy, that tune that God sings. But this time it's land. It's land that requires husbandry. Requires that we care for. Buddhists will talk about as right living, not right in terms of moral, but right in terms of integrity and paying attention to our land. Because if we don't pay attention to the land of our soul, it'll look about us in the world. We see what we can do to each other. So how do we return to this land of our soul and have good husbandry of our soul? And remember that our soul simply is God expressing itself as you and me. Isaiah, and this is drawing on last week, he says that if we're going to take care of the land of our soul, this vineyard on the hillside, we're going to need a nice hedge. I don't know if you recall that from last week, but we're going to need a hedge around the land of our soul. Now, there are different types of hedges. What he means by a hedge is we're going to need a boundary. Souls need boundaries. But there are different types and kinds of boundaries. For instance, we can build We can grow a hedge around our soul, which is pretty darn big, pretty darn thick, and impenetrable, like a wall. Right? We can build a wall around our soul. And no one will get into our soul, and we really won't go out and touch anyone else. It'll be an impermeable boundary. It'll be armor around our soul. Now, oftentimes we build that type of boundary, we grow that type of hedge in which there are no doors, there's no windows, there's no access, because we've been hurt. We've been threatened. It's like Matthew's telling of the parable. The guy, the ruler, was hurt. How dare you do this to the land of my soul? I'm going to build a big wall and you'll never get in. You'll never get in again. We'll control everything in the land. In fact, we might build a wall so high that it'll be like a dome over us, and nothing will ever get in to touch our hearts, our bodies, our hopes, our dreams, our desires, our passions, our pains, our losses. We'll just build a fortress around our soul. That's what our hedge will be. It'll be a fortress. And we'll build it to survive, but we'll actually die. Will be untouched. There will be no intimacy. We build it to survive, but the result is we wither and we die. That's the type of boundary we can build. My sister, who teaches in Saudi Arabia, the largest women's university in the world, I may have mentioned her in the past, she gave me a book when we were out at my nephew's wedding by the spouse of a friend of hers, a woman who attends universities. And this fellow wrote a book about how to navigate Saudi Arabian culture. And it's called Bro Culture, Man Culture. And it's a list of, maybe 360 bullet points about how you navigate Saudi culture. And it begins with boundaries, with walls, impenetrable walls. We make of our soul a compound, and we wither. We become a little gated community unto ourselves. There is another type of boundary, hedge, and it's just the opposite of that one, but kind of similar results. This time our hedge is about this tall, and anybody can step over our hedge. Anybody can come on to the land of our soul and do whatever the hell they want. They can trample our soul. They can abuse our soul. They can be aggressive toward our soul. They can take their position of privilege and just simply run amok over the land of our soul. And sometimes we think that's what it means to be hospitable. You know, we say in our congregation, all are welcome. That doesn't mean you're welcome here to destroy me. But that's sometimes what we can do with our hedge. There's nothing left. Just come right in and do whatever you'd like to me. And our land, it withers and dies. We have no really sense of respect for who we are. When people come in and they're destroyed, there's nothing left of us. It's what the neighbors, you might say, fear for the man in the parable. Why would you go out on the streets and invite these people in? There may be nothing left of the land of your soul. But there is a third kind of hedge we can build around the land of our soul on the side of the mountain that we are. And it's a hedge with doors in it, with windows in it, that we have the power to open and to close. I can let Susan in, I can let her out. I can let Jim in, I can let him out. I let you in. Letting someone into the land of our soul is a very intimate act. It's saying, I trust you. You'll treat me well, and I'll treat you well. It's inviting a stranger in, but there are rules. There is accountability. You don't treat me well and the ones I love well, you leave. You don't have a right to abuse me. You don't have a right to destroy me. You have a right to respect me. And I, you. That's a hedgerow that has a permeable boundary, and people can come and go, and we're adults, and we can make decisions of what's appropriate. That's what the man is doing in the first, or in the parable already. He's inviting people in. I mean, if they misbehave, I'm sure we'll ask them to leave. But he's taking a risk. He's willing to discover. He's willing to be curious. He opens up his life. There's room at the end here. We open the doors. There are expectations, but we open the doors. We care for each other, and we teach each other how to care. That's a healthy vineyard. That's a healthy land of the soul. It's neither closed off nor it's trampled. It breathes. That's a good hedgerow. Isaiah also says we need a watchtower. And you know really what a watchtower is? It's a place to gain perspective. It enables us to see what's going on in the land of our soul. To be curious. Oh, this is what's happening. This is the person who is in the land of my soul. This is the type of conversation I'm having. These are the type of friendships I'm having. These nurture me or they destroy me. They help me or they hinder me. They bring joy or they bring despair. We need a vantage point to see what's going on. That's what the man in the parable has. He has perspective. The first people said no. Okay, they say no. People say no. I'll try some other people. It's not the end of my life. I can try something else. I can take a risk. I can have courage. That's having a watchtower. It's having perspective on what we see and being able to understand what we see. But if we're hunkered down, we can't see anything but the back of our hand. We have no perspective. We see our own, we see our shadow. So Isaiah says if we're going to, at least if I understand it, if we're going to be people who care for the land of our soul, that care for the vineyard that we are, we need to have a watchtower. We need to be able to look upon ourselves and see what's going on, to have perspective. I shared with some folks over the past couple weeks a quote by Pema Chodron, a teacher. And I think she speaks very well about what it is to be people who learn how to nurture the land of our soul so that we care well for ourselves and others, so we don't react out of anger, out of pique, but we are curious and we're responsive. And she says this, a very practical guide for caring for the land of our souls. If your everyday practice is to open to your emotions, to all the people you meet, to all the situations you encounter, without closing down, trusting that you can do that, then that will take you as far as you can go. And then you'll understand all the teachings that anyone has ever taught. Learning to stay open to how we are, how the land of our soul is feeling, what it's thinking. And to respect that. Pema says that'll take us as far as we can ever go in this life. The man in the parable that as I read to you, he may have had some anger. He may have been afraid. He may have felt some shame. He may have felt some reluctance. And he may have been in touch with all those feelings. But what he didn't do is let them dominate his life. And he still opened his heart and his mind and his body to others to let them in. That's caring for the land of our soul. It's developing a vineyard that's juicy, that's enjoyable, that's not cut off from other people, nor is it trampled underfoot by others, but engages with others in a healthy way. So let us return to the land of our soul and nurture it well. Amen.